This is the Superfund Research Program Sediment Bioavailability Assay kickoff webinar featuring new research projects for the Superfund Research Program. My name is Heather Henry. I'm a health science administrator for the Superfund Research Program, and I'll be the moderator for today's session. We're going to get started with the presentations in a few moments, but while we wait for others to log on, I do want to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar-specific URL. That's on the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We also have included short bio sketches of the presenters. So please note the presenters' email addresses. Those are hot linked on the page. So if you have any questions you want to ask directly, you can certainly click on the email address and you'll go right to the presenter email and you can ask them your questions. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones will be placed on mute when you join the call. We will have a question and answer session, however, and at that point, you can take your phone off mute. We're going to let the speakers present their talks, about 10 minutes apiece, and after that time, we're going to open the floor for people to ask questions to that particular speaker. At that point in time, you can take your phone off mute during this question and answer period. So you might want to make note of this. I've certainly made note, but if you want to unmute your phone line during the question and answer session, you'll need to press *7. And in order to mute your phone back again, you hit *6. So I'll go over that again when we get to the question and answer session part of this webinar. This helps us to cut down on the background noise. As many people who have joined on today, we think there might be up to about over 200 people who have logged on and registered via phone or simulcast. So as you can imagine, having too many people unmuted could disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. The other thing that would disrupt the quality is if by some chance you put us on hold and that transmit hold music to the rest of us. So we ask that you don't put us on hold, since a lot of organizations do have hold music or advertisements that can be disrupted to the call. So by now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and should be on slide 1. And those of you participating via the Internet should have clicked on the Go to Session icon, which is near the bottom of the page, and you should be on slide 1 of the presentation. If you go on to slide 2, there's the main page, which contains the slides, above which you will see the navigation icons. So again, if you've gone through the Internet, you'll see that there are navigation icons. So Internet participants can submit questions by using the question mark icon, which is at the top, right above the slides. You don't need to wait until the question and answer period to do that. In fact, we encourage you to submit those questions in advance, and we will take care of them right away. And somebody has reminded us that if you experience technical difficulties, you can also use the question mark icon. And in fact, someone from Seattle has let us know that she's having trouble with the sound. So maybe if that person can let us confirm whether or not the sound has been fixed, we did get your message that you're having trouble with the sound. That was Deborah Johnson from Seattle, Washington. Anyway, if you could, when you have technical difficulties, it's really helpful for us if you include your telephone number where you can be reached. So therefore, if we need to troubleshoot the problem, we can get back to you more directly. So the presenter will be announcing the number of the slide to which they are moving. So you can advance the slide using the right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number, which is on the left-hand frame. So at the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form, and we really ask that you consider filling that out afterwards. We certainly look at your comments, and we try to improve the content and delivery of our webinars, so we really appreciate your input. The feedback and the additional resources will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access the information later on indefinitely. We typically place these seminars in an archive that includes the soundtrack, so in the near future, usually it takes a couple weeks, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. So our past seminars have been available on the CLUIN website and are also available via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program. And that'll take you directly to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information Archives, which is the CLUIN archive. So we're ready to start this session. Once more, I'd like to remind phone participants to keep your phones off mute. And again, please do not put us on hold. So let's go back to slide one. I just want to, again, on behalf of the Superfund Research Program, thank our presenters today. These are the new award recipients for a call for applications for sediment remediation bioavailability assays. And anyhow, they're going to be doing something that SRP has not done in the past, which is to give us an idea about what their research will be about. These are three-year awards, and they've just been awarded in the last year. And so what we're going to be hearing about is what the researchers intend to work on, what their study systems are, their sites where they're doing their research, and the different tools that they're developing in order to help us understand better how effective remediation has been at different sediment contaminated sediment sites, and how remediation has been effective in reducing bioavailability, particularly to the food chain transfer of contaminants. So we're real excited to have all of the new awardees here on the call today, and they'll be talking again for about 10 minutes, giving us an idea about what their research will be about. And we hope that there'll be a lot of discussion afterwards, a lot of interest in the type of research that they're doing. And our hope is that you will want to follow the research that they're doing throughout the course of the award, and we'll all be interested in the results. So our first presentation today is from Dr. Rolf Halden. Dr. Halden is a public health researcher at the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University. He has an appointment as a professor of environmental engineering, co-director of the Center for Health Information and Research, associate director of the SETI Center for Environmental Biotechnology, and is adjunct associate professor in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He has authored over 100 papers, patents, and a book examining the impact of anthropogenic chemicals on environmental quality and human health. He's been invited repeatedly to brief the U.S. EPA, FDA, and the National Academies and U.S. Congress on emerging contaminants and the safety of antimicrobial products. So, Dr. Halden, I will now turn the time over to you, and I will ask the audience to turn to slide number 3, please.
Thanks, Heather. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Great. So we're looking at slide 3 right now. The title is In Situ Sampling Tool for Assessing Bioavailability. I will use the acronym IS2B for this new tool that we are proposing. Let me first introduce the team. So my name is Rolf Halden. I'm a researcher here at the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University. And with me are working two graduate students, doctoral students, Sam Superwitt and Isaac Roll. This is a collaborative research project with a co-PI, the co-PI is Nancy Denslau at the University of Florida. We have a postdoc, Viet Deng, and a supporting staff member, Kevin Kroll. And I'd like to introduce this new approach to measuring the bioavailability of chemicals using the in-situ sampling tool. So essentially what you're looking at slide 3 is a prototype of the device. On the right-hand side, you see something that looks like an arrow. This is an anchor that is pushed into the sediment, and the idea of this device is that it is half buried in the sediment, and that one half is exposed to the bulk water. It is an active sampler that has a pump built in, and can take both pore water and bulk water from the surrounding water simultaneously into the device and then concentrate chemicals from those two different water sources in the device. Let's advance to slide 4. Here you see a kind of a framing of the general issue of contaminants in sediment. I think we all appreciate that sediments are a sink for a lot of chemicals, both naturally occurring and man-made ones. And since a lot of chemicals ultimately end up in sediment, the concentrations of compounds in sediment can be remarkably high. We often find pesticides and other compounds at the hundreds of parts per billion, if not parts per million level. These are milligrams per kilogram dry weight. And due to the large abundance of compounds and chemicals in sediment, there is a concern that these chemicals could pose a risk to macroorganisms, biota, including those that are part of the food chain, and then ultimately can lead to human exposure. We also realize that not all the chemicals that are present in sediment always pose a risk. And so there is an recognition for the fact that only the fraction of chemical or the fraction of the mass of the given compound that is bioavailable is actually posing a potential harm to biota. And so the goal of, I think, all the projects that we're going to discuss in this presentation is to better characterize the fraction of compounds that are bioavailable and that potentially could enter the food chain and lead to human exposures. And the uptake typically takes place by benthic organisms such as the worm shown in the upper row here of this image on slide 4. And then the worms can be consumed by organisms that live in the open water, such as the fish shown. And then if the fish is being caught and becomes part of the human food chain, then we have a mechanism, a route for human exposure. The project deals with two different types of compounds, traditional contaminants and then emerging contaminants. On the lower left side of this slide 4, we see the issue of organochlorine pesticides highlighted. So there's a long history of using chlorinated organic compounds as pesticides in agriculture and other applications. And we have learned over the years that halogenated compounds, and particularly polychlorinated compounds, have adverse effects on human health and environmental health that went underappreciated in the initial years where most of these compounds were used. So since the kind of the heydays of polychlorinated aromatics, we have now banned or restricted the use of a lot of these compounds. But despite the fact that we've done so, we still see these chemicals present in water and in sediment and ultimately also in biota that get in contact with these environmental media. Our study location is located in Florida, where we're looking at the Lake Apopka, and it has very high concentrations of organochlorine pesticides from heavy application of these substances. I also want to point out that these chemicals are not only posing an acute toxicity, but also have chronic toxicity and can function as endocrine disruptors, and that knowledge has emerged only over the last two decades. On the right-hand side of slide 4 at the bottom, we see a graph depicting the effect of contaminants that are sediment-borne and present in Lake Apopka. And so we see that largemouth bass introduced into mesocosms containing contaminated sediment can take up contaminants from the sediment and store them in their body and therefore show a body burden and associated adverse effects. And so here we see data for the accumulation of DDE, DDT, and a number of other compounds, including the different congeners, toxaphene and dieldrin. And these concentrations can be quite high, as you see, up into the hundreds of microgram per gram lipid of the fish tissue. Advancing now to slide 5. In a nutshell, the project that we are proposing and that we have started to work on now is the development of an active sampler that should serve to characterize the bioavailability fraction of chemicals present in both bulk water and pore water. And so the idea here is to capture the chemical that is truly dissolved in the water rather than the mass of compounds that is sorbed to a particle. In order to do this, we chose a technology that is well accepted and practiced around the world in different laboratories. It's called solid phase extraction. Essentially, it's taking a large water sample and passing it through a selective resin that can accumulate different analytes of interest at out of this highly diluted solution. And at the end of the passage of the water volume through the resin, you have more or less purified water and heavily concentrated compounds that are now residing on a small volume, which is the resin. And then the resins are being eluted and can be analyzed and offer very good detection limits. And so we are using in this study here the accepted approach of solid phase extraction to bring it into the in situ environment, and so run an experiment that typically is done in the lab in situ. The benefit of this are multiple. For example, we have the opportunity to unlimited access to water, so we can sample a large amount of water through these resins, and this will obviously give us lower detection limits than are feasible if you only take a small grass sample. We also can determine time average samples, so we are not just taking a time discrete sample, but can run these samples for periods of days or even weeks in the sediment, and therefore get very low detection limits and a typical characteristic concentration. Since we use an active pump, we're also in control of how much water passes along the resins. And in contrast to passive samplers, we therefore can calculate the volume of water that has been processed, and therefore all the mass that we detect in our samples later on is can actually be converted to a true concentration. On slide 5, we see two pictograms here before and after. It shows the presence of a multi-channel pump in the device. After the pump, we split the flow into different channels, and the green cartridges show kind of virgin resin material. As the water passes through these resins, it takes up the different contaminants, and depending on their specific analytes sorptive characteristics, you see that different chemicals can be sorbed, and we see that the cartridges change their color from blue, green to blue, yellow, brown, and orange, and so we can simultaneously concentrate different compounds very effectively in this device. The compounds we're going to look at are a degradate of DDT, the pesticide DDT that is now banned since the 1970s, so we're looking at para-para DDE, and also a dieldrin, and the emerging contaminants we're looking at are fipronil, and then triclosan and triclocarbon. The other two are antimicrobials that are added to a lot of consumer products, antimicrobials consumer products, and we know that these chemicals are very persistent and as well as endocrine disrupting. And so after deployment of the device for days or weeks, it is being retrieved, and then the cartridges are being taken out of the device, and they are handled in a way typical of solid phase extraction. So we pass a small volume of organic solvent through it that washes out all the concentrated chemicals. We now have a very highly concentrated organic solvent solution that can be injected into the GCMS or a similar device, and we can determine the concentration of the different chemicals. Advancing now to slide 6, this provides an overview of the project.
I'm sorry, Rolf, can I jump in for a second?
Sure.
Somebody has asked if you could please speak up a little bit. They're having trouble hearing you.
Okay, let me get
thank you. That's better.
Good. So this slide 6 shows an overview of the project. The goal is to do only a physical measurement with the device we're developing, and from these measurements then determine the or estimate the actual bioavailability of the compound. And in order to do this, we will have to carry out the development of the device, the use of the device, as well as concurrent experiments with animal models to determine what the true uptake and bioavailability of the chemicals of concern are. Our study site is Lake Atapka, the North Shore, with the muck farms that are heavily contaminated with chlorinated pesticides. And our contact there is Roxanne Conroe from the St. John's River Water Management District. And so again, our two lines of experiments will provide measurements with the IS2B device. We will measure bulk water and pore water concentrations in the sediment, and at the same time, we will also determine concentrations in fish and in worm residing in contaminated sediments. We have two parallel types of experiments. One are controlled lab experiments, and once we have learned enough, we will move into the actual site and repeat these analyses at Lake Apopka. And the blue box shows us an overview of all the different types of analyses and measurements we're going to obtain. So we're going to get bulk water, pore water concentrations, colloid concentrations, and so forth, the concentration of the sediment, the contaminants in sediment as well, and then the body burden in worms, in fish, and the biota sediment accumulation factor, also known as BSAF. And all this information will, again, be integrated to formulate a predictive model where we correlate the measurements with the IS2B device to those analyses and results found with the animal model. And this will ultimately then result in a model that can predict from the physical measurement what the likely body burden is in the biota. And this information then could be fed into human risk assessment. Advancing now to the last slide, 7, this gives an overview of the different tools and techniques that we're using in the study. So again, we're working at a Superfund site. Lake Apopka is a Superfund site. The muck farms themselves are not, but the concentrations of the pesticides in this area are highly elevated and of great utility for this particular study. On the left, you see an illustration of the sampler as it is half buried into the sediment, and it shows the two uptake zones, one in the sediment to take up pore water and another one in the bulk water. And then we have two animal models. We're going to use worms and fish. And the fish are going to be analyzed for the toxic body burden as well as the transcriptome, so any changes in the RNA profile that we see as a result of the exposure to the toxic chemicals of interest. And all this information, again, is going to be fed into the predictive model that will then correlate the concentrations detected in the IS2B device to those measurements done on the animal model. And if we succeed in this, and we have about 2.5 years left, then hopefully we have a kind of commercially ready device that we can share with other researchers, and that should enable us to better characterize the bioavailability of different contaminants. And that concludes my presentation. I would like to thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Rolf. That's a great overview of the work that you're doing at ASU and at University of Florida. Thanks very much. I'm going to open the phone lines for questions. Again, to do that, you hit *7 to unmute your line. And a couple questions have come in online, so while those of you on the phones are thinking about your questions, we'll go ahead and ask a question from Paige Lightman from Environ in Atlanta, Georgia. She asks, is there a guide as to which resins are best for which constituents?
Okay, that's a good question. I think what I failed to point out is that the innovative aspect of sampler is that it can analyze a wide array of different compounds, from highly hydrophobic to very hydrophilic. We are only limited by the availability of different resins that are selective enough to take up contaminants, which goes to the core of the question asked. So as you might know, if you open a chemical catalog, you can see that there's a lot of different resins available for hydrophobic chemicals. These are often then GAC, granular activated carbon based, all the way to very water-soluble compounds such as ion exchange resin. And we can, side by side, use these different resin types in the sampler and at the same time sample for very hydrophobic and very hydrophilic compounds. GAC typically concentrates just about any hydrophobic compound, so there's few restrictions there. And for anions and cations, there's also selective resins such as perchlorate selective resins, for example, that enable you to see perchlorate in a fairly strong background of nitrate and other anions.
Great, thank you. Here's a quick question from Kara Warner. Just which fish species are you using? The picture looks like a fathead minnow. Is that the species that will be used?
Yes, so we're going to use a fathead minnow, and we're also going to use aquatic worms. I don't have the name in front of me, Elvar Theriadis, or I wish Nancy was on the phone and could help us out here. But yeah, so these two species are being used first.
Great. Are there any Are there any questions from the phone line? Just hit *7 to unmute your line. State your name and your organization and ask your question.
This is John Wickman from the Corps of Engineers. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi John.
Okay. Since you're pulling water from the sediment, I know it flow at slow flow rates, but since you're pulling water up from the sediment, I wanted to ask, is there any evidence that you might be affecting the quality of the water by such a manipulation? Or maybe another way to put this, is there any limitation on the kinds of sediments you can use your device in that would be to have such slow flow that it would be stressful or something?
John, so I think your question goes to the point whether we disturb the environment while we're doing the sampling. Is that
right.
What you're concerned about? Okay, I think it's not quite clear that the sampling rates, I haven't stated that previously, are very different for the bulk water and for pore water. If we're interested in the bioavailability, so we're interested in equilibrium concentrations in the pore water, and so the flow in the lower section of the device is very, very low. We're talking about, you know, microliters per minute or hour, very low flow rates that you wouldn't, you know, see any impact on the sediment. And then the water is passed through the resins and then, as shown by the red arrow, ejected at the top of the device into the bulk water. So we believe that there will minimal, if no, disturbance of the sediment. And the long sampling times that I indicated are due to the fact that we have to pump the water slowly in order to have, you know, near equilibrium concentrations.
Thank you.
I hope that answers your question.
Right. There are a lot of related questions, and quite a few have come over the through the online participants. If there's time at the end, we'll get back to some of those questions. I'll prepare you, Rolf, you don't have to answer this now, but the cost question has come up, so we'll give you a chance. We might ask that of all of the researchers at the end, but we really need to get on to our next speaker because we know that he has to leave a little bit early, so we want to make sure he has a chance to give his presentation and answer your questions as well. And again, any questions that we were not able to answer online, on the phones, we will make sure that the investigators have a chance to get back to you later. So thanks again, Rolf, for your presentation, and we'll hopefully hear from you a little bit later after we get through the other presentations. So at this point, I'd like to move on to our second presentation and ask those of you to turn to slide 8, those of you who are following along. And our next speaker is Dr. James Ranville. He's an associate professor of the Department of Chemistry and Geochemistry at Colorado School of the Mines. He received a B.S. in chemistry from the Lake Superior State University and M.S. and Ph.D. degrees in geochemistry from Colorado School of the Mines. His research interests focus primarily on the geochemistry of trace metal contaminants, and he's particularly interested in metal speciation analysis, including nanoparticle characterization. So he has authored or co-authored over 50 peer-reviewed papers and book chapters. So at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Jim, and on behalf of his other co-investigators as well, who are listed on slide 8, Jim.
Thank you very much, Heather. And thanks everybody for logging into the webinar. This will be a little bit different in respect that we're now moving from organic contaminants to metallic issues. Certainly bioavailability and water chemistry play a major role in assessing the ecotoxicology of metals in sediments and waters. And so that leads us to our title of the on slide 8, remediation effectiveness for mining sites, looking at hysteresis and metal mixture effects. Part of the driver behind this is there are extensive areas of streams throughout the United States that are impacted by metals as a result of past mining activities. This has left us a major legacy of contaminated sediments. The co-investigators on this particular project, in addition to myself at Colorado School of Mines, is Dr. Christopher Higgins, who's in the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department. He's also with me on the phone here. If you have any questions directed to him. Jim Giant, Harvard School of Public Health, is also on the line. Will Clements, Colorado State University. Joe Meyer, currently at Arcadis. And our site collaborator is Mike Holmes, part of a U.S. EPA Region 8. If we go to slide 9, our study site is the Superfund site, the Blackhawk Central City site. It's located just west of Denver. I've drawn out the watershed on this cartoon, and I've highlighted the specific area of study, which is called the North Fork of Clear Creek. The site's nice and it's quite close to the laboratory here in Golden, so we can get there in about 30 minutes, so it allows us to do a lot of in-stream experiments as well as laboratory experiments. Basically, the issues are abandoned mine sites within the watershed. The North Fork watershed, which is highlighted in that box, really, in addition to some diffuse sources, there are two major point sources. These are a source of acid mine drainage that introduce a number of metals into the system, copper, zinc, and cadmium being probably the ones we're most concerned about from a toxicological point of view, but also iron, aluminum, manganese are introduced in the stream system where they precipitate and form accumulations in the bed sediments. This is a process that's been going on over 100 years, and so we have these legacy issues of sediments that have been introduced into the system, and thus our project. The opportunity we're keying off of here is that these two major sites are going to undergo remediation in the near future, probably the end of 2013. So the major loadings of metals will be removed or at least significantly reduced to this ecosystem. So it gives us an opportunity to look at the recovery of the system, to try to introduce bioavailability concepts and tools for us to see how basically natural remediation or restoration of the stream occurs following the remediation on the system. The metals will be removed by a fairly conventional process, most likely raise the pH to 10 or 11 to precipitate out the metals, remove them by sedimentation, filtration, return the waters to a pH of 8 or so, and then discharge them back in the stream. So the way we're going to look at this, our research approach in the lower right corner, is to combine laboratory studies, which we've been involved with for several years, mesocosm studies, and actual in-stream experiments and field observations. That photograph in the center of the slide is just an example of one of the two drainages, so you get a rough feel for the amount of water being introduced into the stream system. So to slide number 10, this is our picture of how the various projects that we're focusing on interrelate to one another. They all lead back to this goal to understand the rate and success of remediation of a stream system impacted by metals, particularly in the presence of large amounts of sediments deposited in the system. So I want to point out, the slides that will follow this will go over each of these three points, our mixture toxicity studies, which related to our studies of hysteresis. By that I mean, how long will the system actually recover once the metal sources are removed? We particularly expect to see a period where biology will take to recover, and the chemical system will, the sediments in the water will change in composition. And finally, the third point being our look at metal availability in the system, and we'll be looking at both laboratory and field aspects here as well. So we're going to talk about something called the jellyfish sampler, which is a way of looking at free metal ion in solution. Along with this, we'll be looking at the biology of the system, in particular looking at the body burdens of various metals, and including subcellular fractionation. Where are the metals occurring within the organisms themselves? If you go to slide number 11, this is a discussion of the effects of mixture toxicity. What we have to recognize in these systems is that in most cases, organisms are not exposed to one single metal. In the case of these acid mine drains impacted systems, cadmium, zinc, copper are major elements of concern. Now, most regulatory structures involve regulating metals on an individual basis. But we recognize that when we have mixed metals, we have to start looking at how metal mixture toxicity might be affected. We could imagine that metal toxicity might be simply an additive effect, where the dose of each of the metals are added to one another to create a cumulative effect. Or you can imagine it might be less than additive or more than additive effects. What I've wanted to highlight was some of our previous laboratory toxicity testing. And the figure in the lower left is some data from Daphne and Magna experiments that we are currently doing in our lab. And in these systems, we're looking at various mixtures of binary and ternary metals, again, attempting to deal in the laboratory what we're seeing in the field. The data on the left are mortality versus dissolved metal concentration. In these experiments, we have one metal that's held constant, in this case, cadmium, which is held constant about 20 micrograms cadmium per liter, and we vary the second metal, in this case, dissolved zinc. What you notice is on the very left-hand side, this is actually no added zinc, so it probably should be more like about 1 microgram per liter. We see mortality due to cadmium alone ranging from about 50 to 100%. As soon as we start introducing the second metal, in this case zinc, we see an immediate reduction in the toxicity of cadmium. And it goes down to almost no toxic effect whatsoever until as you increase the zinc concentration, you start to introduce zinc toxicity. That gray shaded bar is to represent where about 20% mortality due to zinc alone would kick in. So the way the curves rising on the right essentially represent the zinc toxicity kicking in. As you can see, if you were to try to take an additive model to look at the effects of cadmium at low concentrations with added zinc at low concentrations, it doesn't fit an additive model at all. So this is a challenge we're faced with in trying to assess bioavailability in the real-world situation where metal mixtures occur. And we suggest that concentrations of individual dissolved metals are not going to be good predictors of mixture toxicity. So the tool we hope to develop from this study, this part of the study, is a mixed metal bioavailability model, a computational approach that might be able to handle these non-additive effects of multiple stressors. It may be a biotic ligand model or some other approach, but it hopefully will be a computational tool which will help us see what's actually occurring in stream systems where multiple metals are occurring. We have to follow these laboratory tox tests up with field observations, so we'll continue the work in looking at the actual benthic community and the water column community in the actual field site at in the North Fork. Move to slide 12. This is a discussion of the hysteresis effects. We're recognizing that when you turn off the metals of the system on immediately, and therefore we're going to look at the different hysteresis effects that occur in the system. If you look at the photographs on the left, we also have to recognize that there are different types of sediments present in the system that have accumulated over the years. Some of these materials are heavily armored onto the rocks, as is pictured on the leftmost photo. We suspect that there may be a different rate of removal of this material as the stream system recovers, compared to the center photograph, which shows these loose flocks, which are present throughout the system, but are much more easily disturbed by change in hydrologic conditions and water chemistry. And so in order to get a start on these, looking at these effects, we've begun some field experiments that are going to simulate in some way what we expect to see happening after the remediation. The photograph on the right are a series of trays of rocks that have been placed in the stream. They're there to look at both the chemical deposition of the materials, including the iron and manganese oxides, as well as the associated copper, zinc, cadmium. But these were placed downstream of the mining inputs, and after about a month of accumulation of materials, they were moved to the upstream site, our background control site, with the idea being that that water may represent somewhat the situation after remediation, after the metal loads have been removed. So we're watching how quickly the sediments are lost and how quickly these rocks are recolonized by stream organisms. The tool we really see coming out of this particular part of work is both a conceptual and a computational model that helps us understand the process of desorption, dissolution, mechanical scouring in these real systems and help us to predict when we move to the next site contaminated by similar processes, so we predict or at least have an idea of what type of hysteresis might occur in these other systems. Go to slide 13, which is, I believe, my last slide. This is where we're trying to address probably the most central question involved in this NIEHS-supported project, is to use bioassays and bio monitoring devices to try to look at the role of water chemistry and bioavailability on these processes. So in the field and in the laboratory as well, we're focusing on the use of these materials called jellyfish samplers. These were actually developed mostly by my colleague Jim Schein, who also is on the line, so can answer more questions about these. But the upper left shows a cartoon of the material. The lower left shows a picture of these installed. It's there are two of them above and below that white tray, which is actually a field exposure study of caged organisms. And so the process is that the IDA resin, which is held within this device, it cooperates with the free metal ions. These materials are then taken back to the lab. The metals are desorbed, and we can compute free metal ion concentrations in the solution. And we also hope that this is going to give us some idea about these competitive metal-metal interactions as well as far as binding to ligands. These data will then be correlated to various other things we're looking at with respect to the community response. We have both the potential of looking at gradients throughout the stream. We also have seasonal changes that change the metal levels and the stream composition. So we'll be using our jellyfish data to correlate to the community responses as well as the body burden and the organisms that we will both cage in the stream, but also will collect from the site itself. Again, the organisms have different ways of being able to manage metal exposures, and so we feel like some additional work on looking at subcellular fractions of the metals within the organisms is important, and to be able to relate what we observe in the actual stream system to what we build from our mesocosm experiments and our lab experiments. The tool, of course, from this particular work will be not only the jellyfish sampler, but also the modeling protocols for taking our results from the measurements of free activity to a bioavailability model and an uptake model. With that, I believe I've come to the end of this, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thanks so much, Jim. A number of questions have come in online, so I'll start with those. But after going through those questions, I'll remind those of you on the phone that if you'd like to ask a question, just hit *7, and that will unmute your line. And then you can state your question. Please let us know who you are and where you're from. Question I'd like to ask on behalf of Jerry Black is if the lack of oxygen affects toxicity.
But certainly would be an issue, but in these systems, both the water column is well oxygenated and the upper sediments are rather oxygenated as well. So although from a big picture, yes, but we're working in a purely oxic system at this point.
Great. And Tom Parkerton from ExxonMobil in Houston asked if you will integrate BLM predictions into this study.
That is the current goal of the laboratory mixture toxicity studies, which is to, again, to parameterize a BLM to handle more than one metal, but we do see this as coming out of the field work as well. We'll try to incorporate using real water samples from the site and the water analysis to test and probe the BLM for, again, use in a system that contains more than one metal.
Tom had another question, whether this approach for calibration has been published.
Calibration of the jellyfish sampler?
Right.
Turn it over to Jim Schein.
In review,
okay. Great. We'll look forward to that coming out. For sure, once that does come out, that paper will be linked to from the SRP webpage that describes your project. So that'll be a way that Tom can follow up and learn about the publication there. Are there any questions from the phone line? We have time for one question, and if you'd like to ask a question, please hit *7 to unmute your line.
This is Rick Beach with AMEC Environment. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This may be referenced the same way as the previous question, but How long are the jellyfish samplers typically deployed? Do you have problems with biofouling impacting uptake rates? And does he use performance reference compounds to correct for that?
Okay, so this is Jim Schein here. So the answer is it's an equilibrium device. We want to put them in until they achieve equilibrium. We have different designs. The one you see there equilibrates in about 15 to 20 hours. So you don't get biofilms there. We have some that are a week. And then we've worried about it before, but we've had it in relatively clean systems and had that. So, but if we're doing the short snapshot that you're seeing in the picture on slide 13, they're not in there for very long until they get to equilibrium with their surrounding solution.
So you don't see the need for the performance reference compounds?
Well, you know what? That would be nice. And I was thinking of doing, I don't know, putting like dysprosium or something as a performance reference compound, something exotic. Because that could obviously bring the equilibration talent even further and allow you to do ex situ sampling. So you could take, you know, because if you took a sample of water and has had it sticking around in the lab for 20 hours, I don't think that really represents that original sample anymore. But if, yes, we can get it down to hours with PRCs using exotic metals, yes, we could get equilibration times even lower.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Jim and Jim. In the interest of time, there were a few more questions that came in online, but we'll either get to them later, and if for some reason we aren't able to get to them after the last presentation today, then we will for sure have get back to you directly. At this time, let's move on to our next presentation, which is on slide 14. I'd like to welcome Dr. Upal Ghosh. He's an associate professor and a graduate program director for the Department of Chemical, Biochemical, and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. His research explores fundamental processes, mechanisms that control contaminant fate in soil, sediments, and aquatic environments. His research uses multidisciplinary tools to investigate exposure and bioavailability of organic contaminants to benthic organisms. Dr. Ghosh's recent work has explored the use of sorbent amendments to sediments to reduce the bioavailability of contaminants such as PCBs, PAHs, dioxins, heavy metals, and methylated mercury. The technology is currently being demonstrated at several U.S. EPA Superfund sites, and he has degrees from civil and environmental engineer from the University of Buffalo, Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay. Before joining UMBC, Dr. Ghosh worked at Carnegie Mellon University as a postdoc fellow and at Stanford University as a research associate. So Dr. Ghosh, I'm going to turn it over to you at this point.
Can you hear me?
Yes, can hear you loud and clear.
So this research started a few months ago. Titled Combining Bioavailability Assays with Modeling to Predict PCBs in Fish After Remediation. And our team involves here myself and PhD student Hilda in the Department of Chemical, Biochemical, and Environmental Engineering. I'm collaborating with Dr. Alan Place and his PhD student Aaron from the Institute of Marine and Environmental Technology, part of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. And also in our team, we have Dr. John Conley, who comes with both university and consulting engineering experience from Anchor QEA and has been involved in large numbers of site assessments and development of remediation approaches for Superfund sites. And his primary expertise is in water quality modeling. So with that, let's go to slide number 15. And this provides the motivation for the work that we are doing. The context of our work on bioavailability assessments is in-situ remediation. And we have been working on this area for several years now, looking at ways to manipulate sediment geochemistry to change bioavailability to our benefit, which is, for our case here, looking at reducing bioavailability by binding up chemicals in situ. And when we do that, one of the key questions that come up is how do we monitor effectiveness of an in situ remedy? And in our mind, the correct measures of success for any kind of an in situ management or treatment is direct measurements of exposure pathways to receptors that we are concerned about. And in our case, the receptors could be either a top predator or humans who could be eating the fish. So the picture here shows uptake of legacy toxic chemical like PCBs, which have two primary pathways of exposure into fish. And by doing in-situ treatment, either by amending the sediment with a strong adsorbent or some kind of a capping method, one is able to knock out or reduce these exposure pathways. And the traditional measurement of remediation success, which involves looking at levels of contaminants left behind, may not be suitable measures of success in conditions where we are looking at reducing bioavailability and not mass of the chemical. So if for a given site we have we find that reducing bioavailability is a way forward, then we need to be able to measure those reductions in bioavailability to be able to inform decision making for exposure, changes in exposure from that remediation. So with that, I'll go on to the next slide here, which shows some of the work that we have done in the past and which leads to the basic research questions that we ask in this project. And this shows a snapshot of data from work we did last few years at Grass River, New York. This is upstate New York with PCBs in sediments. And we have been working at demonstrating the effectiveness of carbon amendment into sediments to reduce uptake of PCBs in benthic organisms and also flux from sediment into the water column. And the picture here on the right shows PhD student Barbara Beckingham getting ready to deploy caged organisms and in-situ passive samplers for deployment in the river in treated and untreated sites. So one of the things we are looking at here as a function of treatment was to look at how the treatment reduced uptake of PCBs, benthic organisms deployed in cages in the control site versus the treated sites. And also along with that, we wanted to get a measure of pore water and surface water dissolved concentrations of PCBs. And we did that in this study with equilibrium passive samplers. And in this study, we're using polyoxymethylene thin films. So these are polymers that have a high capacity to absorb PCBs. And we deploy them for a period of time and then recover it from the field to get an estimate of uptake in these polymers. And then we can back out the dissolved concentrations of the different PCB congeners. So the type of information that comes out of that kind of work is shown in the figure there, which shows concentrations of fully dissolved PCBs either in an untreated site, which is the red set of symbols and lines, and the carbon-treated site, which is the black line. So what's shown here in the profile is surface water on the top and deep sediment pore water, and then interfacial region on the top surface of the sediments where there is mixing with the between the pore water and the surface water. And what you see here is not something that you this is something that one would expect. That is, for a site like this where we have legacy contaminants in sediments, which is the primary exposure, which is the primary source of PCBs into the water column, that that has elevated pore water concentrations in the sediment. And as you go to the top surface, the surface sediments are very close to equilibrium with surface water concentrations, which are lower. So from this information, we can then calculate flux if we know the mass transfer coefficient between the sediment and the water phase. Compared to that, if you look at what happens when we amend the sediment with a strong adsorbent, in this case activated carbon, then the pore water concentrations are greatly reduced in the sediment phase, which, in fact, in this case, reverses the the concentration gradient, with surface water being higher concentration than the sediment itself. So the sediments are no longer acting as a source of PCBs into the water column. But to be able to do that, we need to be able to measure accurately these pore water concentrations, really be able to understand how long it takes for the equilibrium pore water samplers to come to equilibrium with the surrounding water. And if we need to use preference reference compounds for some of the chemicals involved, which diffuse more slowly. And so that leads us to before we go to the next slide, I want to emphasize here the bioavailability measurements that we make are useful when they can be used to measure exposure pathways. And that's the core of our research objectives here, is to be able to develop these methods of assessments of bioavailability so that they are meaningful, not as an empirical way of using a passive sampling measurement being compared with tissue uptake or fish uptake, but actually being able to use the numbers quantitatively to be able to assess exposure pathways into the receptors that are of concern. So with that background, let's quickly go through these research aims, which is in slide number 17 here. So the specific aim number one is derived from the objective of developing these passive samplers and understand the fundamental basis of how these passive samplers work. There is a lot out there in the field that are being used, and some of them we understand better than others. There are polyethylene samplers, polyoxymethylene samplers. There are TDMS samplers and a whole range of other organic polymers that are used. So the approach that we are going to take in this study is using a combination of thin sectioning and microscale measurements to really quantify diffusion kinetics into the common polymers that are used in these measurements. Specific aim number two is to use passive sampling to measure bioavailability processes and uptake in fish, and this is primarily based on lab experimental work that we will be doing in collaboration with Dr. Allen Place. And we'll be performing aquaria studies, and I'll show you some pictures in the next slide, to look at uptake in a pelagic and a benthic feeding fish for treated and untreated PCB-impacted sediments that come from an impacted site like the Grass River. And we'll be looking at using passive samplers to assess pore water and surface water concentrations, measure concentrations in worms and also in algae and Daphnia that may be feeding on the algae, and really build up the, calibrate the full food chain model within the aquaria to be able to see how effective the passive samplers are in being able to tell us in a very controlled environment how the food chain is functioning in terms of uptake of PCBs. Specific aim number three would incorporate passive sampling inputs to PCB fate and bioaccumulation model. This is where Dr. John Connolly comes in with his years of expertise in using bioaccumulation models and food chain models to inform decision-making at Superfund sites. And we would use the models to interpret results from the mesocosm experiments in the lab and also for field observations that we propose to make, understanding efficacy of in-situ remediation on PCB accumulation. So with that, let's go to slide number 18 here, which shows one of our experimental setups in the lab at the Institute of Marine Biotechnology. This is the picture shows Dr. Allen Place in front of a set of gallery of aquaria where we started our first set of exposures. And these aquaria have PCB-impacted sediments treated with carbon to reduce bioavailability, and also background clean sediments. And we have, right now we have one species of pelagic feeder in these aquaria. And the aquaria have also passive samplers that are deployed in the sediments and also in the water column. In future, we'll be expanding this to understand how algae, Daphnia, and oligochaetes behave in these systems and accumulate PCBs and how those can be predicted using the passive sampling uptake measurements and the pore water concentrations that we derive. Sediments that we are using currently are from Grass River, New York. With that, I come to slide number 19, acknowledgments to students who are doing the heavy lifting on this project, Hilda and Aaron. Source of funding, of course, NIEH's Superfund research program. And I'd like to thank Larry McShea from Alcoa for providing us with sediments for this day.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
Great. There's been a couple questions that have come in online, so I'm going to ask two of those questions and then turn to the phone participants for their questions. So the two online questions that I just wanted to quickly get through from Kara Warner from Golder Associates in Oregon, wondered what your source of activated carbon is, whether it's coal or coconut. And I'll go ahead and ask the other question, too, from Lawrence Burkhard from US EPA in Duluth, Minnesota. What species of fish is in the laboratory studies?
Sure. The first question, coal, the type of activated carbon used. For the PCB-impacted sediments, we are planning to use a bituminous coal-based activated carbon. That's what we're using for the initial Aquaria studies, and we'll very likely use that. That's worked out very well for PCBs in our past studies. There are some differences between the different types of carbons based on their source, and which determines their pore structure and makes them more or less effective for molecules of a certain size. So I can communicate in more detail about the types of carbon if Carol wants to send me an email. The other question was
the species of fish in the laboratory studies.
The first set of experiments we started on is with zebrafish because that's what was available and we know a lot about the biology of. But we have the option open right now to reconsider that and look at, we are looking at some kind of catfish, small catfish for the benthic feeder, and one of the common pelagic feeders that we are trying to nail down on. Alan would, I'd have to consult with Alan on his latest thinking on the pelagic feeder.
You're going to ask Alan right now?
Alan, can you jump in and try to address the question on the pelagic fish that we might like to use moving forward?
But is it
Alan would need to hit *7 to unmute his line. He could be trying to speak to us right now.
I can get back on this later.
Okay, great. And we'll provide you email addresses. Again, are there any questions from our participants on the phone? If there are, please hit *7 to unmute your line. State your name, your organization, and ask your question.
This is Rick Beach with AMEC again. May as well throw in another one. Can Upal give us a reference for the thin layer sectioning that he's using or the microscale work he's doing, or is he doing something new?
This will be something totally new. This has not been done before. We have done thin sectioning before to look at contaminant profiles in sediment particles to understand how deeply contaminants go inside particles. And I can send you the paper that we published several years ago on that. But to my knowledge, this has not been done for passive samplers, and so this will be covering new ground there.
Okay. I'll send you a note to remind you of my email. Thank you.
Yes. Any questions that have been asked or those we haven't gotten around to asking, we'll submit both to the presenters. So if there's any follow-up points they'd like to add, even for a question that was asked online, we'll be sure that information gets to them and that they're able to respond more substantively if needed. So there was one more question. How thick is the surface water sediment interface zone shown on the slide? That's from Nicholas Steenhout from Environ in Boston, Massachusetts.
Sure, that's a really good question, and that would really depend on the site. And our assessment here for this sediment, which had really a fluffy layer on the top, would be the top 2 centimeters of the sediment. Don't take that as a standard for any site. It could really depend on the nature of the sediments for a given site.
What you missed.
Great. Are there any other questions on phone? If so, please press *7. Okay, a couple more questions did come on online from Carl DuPont from Green Building Solutions. Do you use a benthic macroinvertebrates for indicator species?
Yes, for a lot of our work with freshwater sediments, we have used Lumbriculus variegatus. It's a freshwater oligochaete, which is very commonly used and has a standard EPA method for doing bioaccumulation studies with. And for marine systems or estuarine systems, we have used an amphipod. But for our current study, we are planning to use freshwater sediments, so the oligochaete would be the organism of choice.
Great. Thanks for clarifying that. At this point, I'd like to move on to our next presenter. And again, any questions that we didn't get to, for sure, we'll have let the presenters know about those questions so they can respond to you. Or better yet, we'll try to get to them at the end of the presentation. So thank you very much, Dr. Ghosh, and thanks everyone out there for your very interesting questions. Let's move on to our fourth presentation from Dr. Michael Unger. He has experience in conducting ultratrace analytical method development, PAH exposure studies, and hydrophobic chemical partitioning experiments. He has studied PAH contamination in the Elizabeth River for over 25 years, and in recent years he's been an advisor to groups conducting and overseeing the remediation of contaminated sediments, including Superfund sites, and he's aware of the need for better technology to assess the fate and risk of sediment associated with contaminants and the efficacy of remediation. He received his BS from Michigan State University and master's and PhD from the College of William and Mary. His current research focuses on the ways in which chemical and physical behavior of aquatic pollutants affect their fate and bioavailability to marine organisms. Dr. Unger, I'll go ahead and turn it over to you. And let's everybody make sure we're on slide 20.
Thank you, Heather. The title of our talk today is a real-time antibody-based field assay to predict contaminant bioavailability in sediments. And this is a group project with my co-investigators Stephen Katari and Wolfgang Vogelbein, who are here with me to answer questions if needed. And we have a collaborator, Joe Rieger, from the Elizabeth River Project, and we're also collaborating with Randy Sturgeon at the EPA Superfund site in Elizabeth River. As you've heard from our other presenters today, new bioaccumulation models are needed because the analysis of biota is expensive, time-consuming, and often impractical in contaminated environments. Variability in sediments can hinder model predictions based on sediment bulk properties, and many of the techniques we're talking about today are methods to sample or analyze pore water as a predictor of the bioavailable component in the bulk sediment. For this NIH SRP project, we're going to be evaluating and refining and trying to validate a quantitative monoclonal antibody-based sensor to measure polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, in sediment-associated water as a rapid predictor of pH bioaccumulation in the oyster. This technology is something we've been working with for the past few years to develop a near real-time technique to measure low levels of PAHs in aquatic samples. Let's go to the next slide, please. Slide 21. The antibody-based technology that we're using is based on an instrument developed by Sapodyne Instruments Incorporated. It's the Kinexa inline sensor. And it's based on an antibody association with the contaminant of concern in the aquatic sample. The antibody is labeled with a fluorescent tag, and the instrument essentially measures this fluorescent signal as a function of the concentration of contaminant in the solution. It's rapid, we can analyze the sample in a few minutes, and it requires a very small sample volume, which is nice for us to apply this in a field scenario. the contaminant selectivity is based on the antibody used in the instrument. In our case, we're using a pH-selective antibody that was developed in our laboratory in collaboration with Dr. Candace Spear, who was a graduate student at the time. And it's very sensitive. We can look at sub-part per billion concentrations in aqueous samples. It's precise. And the antibody that we're working with initially is selective for 3 to 5 ring PAHs. We've used this instrument in the field in the Elizabeth River and looked at it, used it to analyze pH concentrations in the water column as a function of an ongoing sediment remediation effort. This was an effort put on by the Elizabeth River Project where they were dredging out contaminated, highly contaminated sediments in association with a remediation cleanup. As part of that remediation plan and the dredging, there was sediment curves put in place. That in the small inset photograph near the bottom, you can see the dredge head, the dredging operation. There's actually a small blip there as our boat with the biosensor on board. And the engineers on shore were concerned about the potential for pH concentrations increasing in the water column during the sediment dredging operation. We were able to collect samples and transects in the river during the dredging operation, analyze them on board, and report back concentrations to engineers on shore. And what we found was that we were able to trace a gradient from the middle of the river up to the higher concentrations near the dredging operation. And the instrument was sensitive enough to show this gradient even though the concentrations were quite low, just a few parts per billion. Subsequent large volume samples were brought back to the lab, and we saw a good correlation with GCMS analysis in the subsequent weeks following the analysis. So what we have is a system that's sensitive, it's rapid, we can do it in a few minutes, we can operate it in the field, and we can use very small volumes of water. Next slide, please. Slide 22. Our proposed study sites for our project are located in the Southern Chesapeake Bay. We have 6 sites in the Elizabeth River and the associated Lafayette River. And we're very fortunate to have this in our backyard. We have 6 sites with a wide range of pH contamination. Most of these sites are historical contamination sites that were creosote spills and are associated with creosote operations. Our control sites are on the order of five orders of magnitude lower than the highly contaminated sites. 2 of our most contaminated sites are in the southern branch, and they include the Atlantic Wood Industry Superfund site. As I mentioned earlier, our contact there is Randy Sturgeon of EPA. This site is undergoing remediation now. There's construction underway to produce an area to dredge out the most severely contaminated sediments and put them behind a pile wall and isolate the contaminated sediments. We have a historical site of Republic Creosote, which is also in the southern branch, south of the Atlantic Wood site. This site is not slated for remediation in the near future, so it's, in essence, a positive control site for us. And we're fortunate to have the Money Point sediment remediation site in the southern branch, south of both of those. This site has been undergoing sediment remediation by the Elizabeth River Project, and it's been operating in 3 phases. Phase 1 is completed, and Phase 2 is completed, and these involve dredging of the most contaminated sediments, capping, and also capping with organic enriched sediment overlying material. The Phase 3 is not completed yet, so we perhaps will have the opportunity to look at remediated sediment and pore water concentrations as well as overlying water at pre-remediated and post-remediation at this site. So we have 6 sites with a wide range of pH contamination, and what we want to do is measure pHs in the water, the pore water with the biosensor, and then also we look at GCMS measurements of pHs in the water, pore water, sediment, and oyster tissues to develop an empirical-based model to look at these near real-time measurements in the field can ultimately be used to predict bioaccumulation in native oysters. We will also be using transplants at the various sites. So the next slide, slide 23. Aim 2 of our project is also to conduct controlled laboratory dosing of oysters to validate the biosensor as an effective predictor of oyster tissue burdens. Here we want to have more control of our exposures over time, and we'll bring in contaminated sediments from the field and generate large volume pore water samples solutions with a generator column and dose the oysters over time. This will allow us to look at a wide range in different distributions of pHs from the various sites and also to control concentration. We hope with this exposure system to also be able to evaluate different antibodies and look at their effectiveness at predicting the bioaccumulation under these controlled conditions. So we hope to, in addition to that, use the system to look at various in situ sediment remediation techniques. With this column pore water generator, we can also supplement it with carbon-enhanced in situ treatment and see how that affects pore water generation through the contaminated sediments. Let's go on to the next slide, slide 24. So our third aim for this experiment, experimental procedures, is to look at our current biosensor capabilities and extend those with additional antibodies and look at the development of a bi- or multi-analyte biosensor to permit the rapid combined monitoring of different classes of compounds. We've done some preliminary work with different antibodies and shown that we can actually utilize multiple antibodies to analyze the same sample in rapid succession. And based on the results of our field and laboratory evaluations, we hope to develop a repertoire of pH antibodies to improve the biosensor prediction and capabilities for specific pHs or group of pHs that are accumulated by the oysters. So in summary, we have three specific aims. One is to understand how pH concentrations measured by the antibody detection in the aqueous phase can predict biologically available fraction of the total contaminant pool in sediments. Number two is to understand how sediment characteristics or remediation approaches influence the bioavailability and steady state bioaccumulation of pH in aqueous phase. And ultimately, the last one is to understand how additional antibody specificities can be used in combination to better predict the contaminant bioavailability to aquatic organisms. I think that's our last slide.
Great. Thanks very much.
And I'd like to answer any questions I can.
Great. Is there any questions on the phone? I encourage you to ask your question right now. You can do so by pressing *7 to unmute your line. When you do so, please state your name, your organization, and ask your question. So I'm going to leave it open to the phones first this time. Again, press *7 to unmute your line. Somebody trying to ask a question. I hear some voices. Again, it's *7 to unmute the line and then *6 to mute the line again. Okay, since it's quiet, I'm going to ask a question from online.
Okay.
This is from Jerry Black from Black & Associates in Norman, Oklahoma, and he asks whether the results may be used to evaluate freshwater systems.
Absolutely. Well, the results for this experiment are obviously geared towards oysters, but the techniques that we're using and the principles that we're using should be applicable to freshwater systems as well. We have used the detector system to look at contaminants like TNT in freshwater systems, but we haven't addressed the bioavailability issue yet with that compound.
Thanks. Are there any questions from the phone lines? Again, to ask your question, press *7 to unmute your line. I guess it's gotten to be quiet. Maybe what we'll do next is move on to our next presenter, and then if there are any other questions that come up for Dr. Unger, those questions can be submitted online, or we'll have a little bit of time towards the end to ask those questions. So our next speaker is Dr. Jay Gann. He's currently a professor of environmental chemistry in the Department of Environmental Sciences at University of California, Riverside, where he served as the department chair from 2007 to 2010. He joined the Riverside faculty in 2001 following 8 years service as a research scientist with the USDA Agricultural Research Service Laboratory in Riverside, California. He received his PhD in environmental chemistry from Zhejiang University in Hangzhou, China, and was a postdoctoral fellow with the IAEA's laboratory in Seibersdorf, Austria, and the University of Minnesota in St. Paul, Minnesota. His research is related to the environmental fate, transport, and risk assessment of pesticides, wastewater trace pollutants, and persistent organic pollutants, with an emphasis on water quality and risk mitigation. He's authored over 185 technical journal articles and edited 4 books. He supervises 5 PhD students majoring in environmental sciences to environmental toxicology and teaches fate and transport of contaminants in soils as well as environmental organic chemistry at Riverside. He was elected fellow of the AAAS in 2008. He's a fellow of the American Society of Agronomy in 2006. And a fellow of the Soil Science Society of America in 2010. Dr. Gann, I will now turn time over to you.
Oh, hi, everybody. This is Jay Gann. Thank you, Heather, and also thanks to Justin Cran for making this happen. Can you guys hear me okay?
We sure can.
Okay. We're at slide number 25. The PIs for this project are myself and also Professor Dan Schlenk, who is a fish toxicologist at UCR. And we will collaborate with Dr. Keith Maruya at SCWRP and Joe Gully at L.A. County Sanitation District. We're all pretty close by. Currently, we have 2 postdocs and 1 PhD student working on this project. The main objective of this project is to develop a simple bioavailability measurement method for sediments and also potentially also for soils that any lab can use. And our method is based on the use of state isotope labeled compounds. Move to next slide. Well, I think the reason that we need to consider bioavailability in risk assessment or remediation is simply that our contaminants all have the property to strongly absorb to sediment particles, which is why we have contaminant sediments in the first place. And as we know that a sediment really is not simply a solid mass. A sediment, in fact, has multiple physical phases, including the solid phase, water, and also the colloidal phase, or DOM phase. And our contaminants are physically distributed among these different physical phases. And on the other hand, exposure, bioaccumulation, or toxicity is only related to the water phase because only the free molecules, as we know, of the contaminant can cross our cell membrane and cause toxicological effects. So this mismatch between the physical location of a contaminant and where organism exposure takes place is really the fundamental basis that why we have to consider bioavailability in our management of the environment. Slide number 27. So let's look at this diagram on the first at the left. A contaminant, as we know, in a sediment sample is really made of 3 parts. The freely dissolved form in the pore water that is should be directly bioavailable, and the fraction that may be dissolved or is potentially bioavailable, which is represented by the diamond, basically. And the part that is not reversible, reversibly dissolvable, and it's not bioavailable, which is the rectangle on the top. So our conventional methods really extract all 3 parts and give us the bulk concentration, which is what we typically measure, but really does not provide any information on the bioavailability of the contaminant. The second set of methods in the middle aim to measure the freely dissolved plus the reversibly dissolvable fractions, basically the middle 2 parts, the circle and the diamond. And this measurement is called bioaccessibility measurement because it measures what is potentially bioavailable through desorption. The last set of methods only measure the freely desorbed concentration, and such measurement is typically called equilibrium samplers or passive samplers, like Dr. Ghosh talked about. Now moving to slide number 28. For the last 20 years or so, researchers have tried different methods. For example, researchers have developed a number of methods to measure bioaccessibility. And these methods all use the principle of partial extraction, which include, for example, mild solvent extraction, tannic extraction, cyclodextrin extraction, among other methods. And these methods all are very simple to use because no special equipment is needed. However, they all suffer from a common drawback, which is that the measurement really depends on the operational conditions, such as what type of solvent you use, or how long the extraction you use, or even how fast you stir your sample, for example. And tannic extraction and also hydrodextrin extraction, as we know, they're also very time-consuming and very, very tedious. So moving to slide number 29, and here really is the meat of our project. We believe that we can address these limitations by using isotope exchange or dilution method. And the end product of this project, we hope, is an easy-to-use and reproducible method for measuring bioaccessibility. I want to say that the same concept has been used, I'm sure some of you know, for many years for heavy metals by using, for example, radioactive isotopes. However, this concept, for some reason, has not been used for organic contaminants. See, let's say you have a sediment sample that was contaminated with DDE from many years ago, 30 years ago, and you are doubtful how bioavailable the DDE is in your sample after remediation or during remediation or before remediation. So what you can do is to you introduce an isotope labeled DDE, for example, C13 labeled DDE or deuterium labeled DDE. And the newly introduced labeled DDE then will exchange with the native DDE molecules because they are essentially the same molecules. The native DDE concentration really is made of two parts, we can say. One is exchangeable with the isotope labeled DDE, and the other is not exchangeable with the isotope labeled DDE. And the exchangeable portion is the so-called E value. That's a symbol that's used in heavy metals, which is given by the equation on the right. And this E value should really closely indicate bioaccessibility or bioavailability. Measuring E is really simple. You add a known amount of stable isotope labeled DDE, for example, to the sediment. Then you mix the sample for some time to allow the exchange to complete. Then you centrifuge the sample. Then you analyze the water sample for both the labeled and non-labeled DDE using GCMS, for example, in the same run. Then E can easily be calculated using the simple equation on the slide. So moving to slide number 30. So in preliminary experiments, we test this approach. We used deuterium-labeled, D-labeled, pyrene, and also bifenthrin. By the way, the labeled standards are very cheap nowadays. For example, 100 milligram of D10 pyrene is only $55, which is really not different from the non-labeled standard. In this case, we used five sediments with different OC contents, and we measured the E values, and also we simultaneously measured the bioaccumulation by using a benthic invertebrate, Chironomus tentans. As you can see here, there is a very close correlation between the BSAF value and the E value, clearly suggesting that E does indicate bioavailability. So I want to comment that the isotope exchange method should be easily adoptable in most labs nowadays because nowadays stable isotope labeled compounds are everywhere. They are widely available, and the cost is a fraction of what used to be. For example, if you go to Cambridge Isotope Labs, the website, or CDM Isotope Lab website, you can find thousands of compounds labeled with C13, especially those compounds we're concerned about, labeled with C13, labeled with deuterium, or labeled with oxygen 18. And the prices, especially for the deuterium-labeled compounds, are not much more than the non-labeled standards. And also we know that use of stable isotopes, unlike radioactive isotopes, has no safety concerns. And also, as we all know, nowadays, any decent lab nowadays has GCMS or LCMS that can easily differentiate labeled and non-labeled compounds in one injection. And in fact, many labs, as we know, are already using labeled compounds as either internal standards or recovery surrogates. So all these points really add to the point that the isotope exchange method is highly feasible and easily adoptable. So coming to my last slide, slide 31. An important part of our project is to optimize, of course, this method and then apply this method to our Superfund site. And this site is a vast area of DDT and PCB contaminated ocean floor along the Los Angeles coast. And this Superfund site is undergoing remediation, and we will collaborate with the LA County Sanitation District, SCORP, and also other entities to test our method. The picture you're seeing here is a picture I took on a sampling trip in February. You can see people still were wearing shorts at that time. So we're very hopeful that this approach or variations of this approach can become a method of choice for assessing bioavailability of hydrophobic compounds or hydrophobic persistent bioaccumulative contaminants in sediments and also soils, simply because of the simplicity and also the easiness to use this method. So with that, I'm ready to take some questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Gann. We have a question from online participant. This is from Tom Parkerton from ExxonMobil, and he wants to know, why are the slopes for the different compounds on slide 30 different?
Oh, hi, Tom. The slope of the, the bioaccumulation, you know, this is from our preliminary experiment, and yes, we understand that probably because of these compounds, they are metabolized differently in the worm. And I understand that, you know, to make this method more useful as for other methods, we want to really, you know, make sure that this method have the predicting power. And but again, I think my assumption is, you know, these compounds, they are metabolized to different degrees. From what I know, for example, bifenthrin can easily be metabolized. Pyrene probably is relatively stable. Maybe that causes the difference.
Great. I'd like to open the phone lines for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press *7 to unmute your line, state your name and your organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Again, *7 to unmute your line.
Jay, this is Tom Parkerton. Just a quick question. How long do you equilibrate for the exchange to occur?
Tom, I didn't show the data here, but the first thing we did is to look at the kinetics. And we found 48 hours was, for most compounds we have tested so far, is a good time for reach the steady state. And after 48 hours of mixing, then you do not really see any further increase. We think 48 hours or shaking for 2 days is a good time.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any other questions from online participants? Press star 7 to unmute your line, state your name and your organization. Star 7 to unmute your line and ask a question to Dr. Dan. Any further questions? Well, I think there are a number of questions that we can ask of all of the presenters, and there were quite a few questions that had not been answered yet, so there'll be lots of questions to get to. One did come in for you, Dr. Dan, another one. This is from Daniel Lee from Arcadis, Walnut Creek, California. Daniel wants to know, has this method been applied to soils? And are the methods described for sediments the same as they would be for the soils?
Precisely. I think this method should work for both soils and sediments. There should be no difference.
Great. Certainly good to hear that it's versatile. And thanks for that question.
Thank you.
Before we open the question and answer session to all five presenters, I did want to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page and the online feedback form. So if you would turn to slide 32, you'll see the resources and feedback information. And there's an additional resources link as well as a feedback form. And anyway, this will stay with the webinar web page. And you can track it indefinitely to access the presentation. And we typically place the seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations again. Something that we're going to add to the additional resources page is a complete listing of other sediment research that's ongoing within the Superfund research program. There are a number of research projects that we support now or that have recently supported, whether it's ecotoxicology of contaminated sediments, other devices and tools for measuring and assessing bioavailability and food chain transport from contaminated sediments into biota, as well as different remediation strategies. So we encourage you to have a look at our additional resources page to access that. And again, slide 33 shows you the ways to stay connected. You can follow on CLUIN for Facebook and then Twitter starting now to stay in touch with SRP and the different webinars that we have. So I'll now open the question and answer session to all five presenters. Again, people are more than welcome to ask a question. If you would like to do so, you need to press star 7 to unmute your line, state your name and your organization, and ask your question. There were a couple questions that came in that could really go for each of the presenters, so I'll just ask them to go in the order of their presentation, starting with Rolf. This question came from Lawrence Burkhart, U.S. EPA, Duluth, Minnesota. And he was asking specifically to Rolf, but I think this can go to any of the presenters, what is the general price or the price per sample of the device that you're working on? And it's fine to say that it's too early to tell at this point, but it certainly gives us an idea of what the ballpark is for these devices. So, Rolf, can we start with you?
Yeah, thanks, Heather. I think that's an excellent question, particularly for the first presentation, which dealt with an active sampling device that has a pump built in, therefore will be a little more expensive. So we are not in a position right now to give a firm estimate of this, but we believe that it's commercially viable and that the cost of the capital investment for a sampler would be on the order of maybe $1,500 to $4,000. The sampler is reusable many times over, hundreds or thousands of times, and there are consumables in the device that will only last for a single measurement. These are the cartridges and then the tubing used in the peristaltic pumps. We estimate that the cost of the resin is on the order of a dollar to up to maybe $20 to $50 per cartridge, depending on how sophisticated the sorbent is and the dimension of the resin, and then a few dollars for the disposable tubing. So overall, the expense is in line with typical environmental sampling, and actually a little lower. Since this is an active sampler, we don't need isotope-labeled compounds, so that reduces the cost on a per-sample basis.
Great, thanks. Jim Schein, are you on the line? Can you...
I'm here. Okay, so since ours, unlike Rolf, it's a passive sampler, so we don't have pumps. And so the materials alone cost about between $5 and $10. So it'd be, if there's no labor involved, each sampler would be $5 to $10. If we put in labor, it gets up to around $40 to $50 per sampler. And they are reusable. And we've tested how reusable they are, and we've done them 3, 4, 5 times and still get the same results.
Great, thanks. I believe the next present...
would be me, Paul, I think.
Dr. Ghosh, yep.
The samplers used, the materials used for passive sampling like polyethylene or polyoxymethylene are really inexpensive, less than a dollar per sampler. But, you know, that doesn't mean that the method itself is really low cost, because the personnel involved in interpreting passive sampler data is going to be a trained personnel. So there's going to be a cost associated with interpretation of the data. It's not going to be as straightforward as a direct measurement of sediment concentration or water phase concentration. So that has to be worked out. I cannot say what that cost would be, but there is a difference in the handling of the data and the interpretation of the data.
Great. Dr. Unger?
Yeah, ours is actually a very different sort of apples and oranges here. We're actually using an analytical instrument. So the initial cost of the commercial instrument is probably on the order of $70,000, roughly. And then the actual samples and reagents to run a sampler is literally pennies per sample. But the difference here is we're not looking at a sampler. We're looking at actual in-the-field analysis. So it would be equivalent of combining both our sampling and, say, your GCMS analysis together. So it's a little different.
Okay. That's understandable. Dr. Gann?
This is a very good question. I think that's a question that people always ask when you use stable isotopes. I would say, you know, things have changed. Nowadays, isotope-labeled compounds are pretty inexpensive, especially if it's deuterium-labeled compounds. But still, if you have a mixture of, say, 10, 20 compounds, then costs will add up. And I think the providers nowadays, they also provide mixtures of, say, pHs or PCBs. And I hope, you know, if they're, maybe if EPA is behind this, maybe we can make those vendors to produce more of those mixtures. Then the cost would be very minimal, I would say, because these compounds, label compounds, are used by many labs anyways as surrogates or internal standards. Since we don't need any additional device, I think, you know, the cost really is consumables and should not really be that much.
Okay. And a number of people had asked questions as well, whether the devices that you've described can be used in freshwater or saltwater estuarine environments, or, you know, who knows, maybe even in soil or groundwater. So maybe if we can just go again through the line. Some of you have already answered that question. It's a quick question, but Rolf, let's start with you. Is your tool also available for freshwater environment? And would there be other environments where it can be used?
Yes, the active sampler we described, the IS, usable for any saturated environment. So even a saturated soil, it wouldn't work in unsaturated environments.
Okay. Great. And Jim Shine, are you still on the line?
I didn't go anywhere.
Okay.
So this was, our device was designed for marine ecosystems. So we have papers published on that for marine ecosystems, where the pH is pretty stable from 7.8 to 8.1, even in estuarine zones. So part of this is our first attempt at looking at these things in a freshwater system, which might have a more varied pH, a more varied hardness, alkalinity. So we have these other cations to be concerned about competitive displacements of metals on the device. So that's part of the research that's going on to validate this for freshwater.
Great. Dr. Ghosh?
The approach that we're taking would be applicable for saturated environments. We, on a different project, we have used acid sampling to measure equilibrium partitioning for dioxins in soils. So it's possible to adapt it. But, you know, what we're developing here is not quite one tool, but an approach to assess the feasibility of using passive samplers to inform decision making. So the approach should be applicable, but the actual application or the method of deployment would have to vary and adapt to the site.
Okay. Dr. Unger?
Yes, our instrumentation is adaptable to fresh or estuarine or marine environments. We just need an aqueous sample, so at probably a minimum of half a mil.
And Dr. Gann?
Yeah, I would say yes, because it's, you know, our technique is essentially an analytical method, so regardless of the samples, I don't think this is a problem.
Okay, great. And then another question came from Daniel Lee of Arcadis, Walnut Creek, California. This is to all the presenters. Have any of these methods described during the webinar been used to conduct quantitative human health or ecological risk assessment? And if so, what has been the agency, whether it's U.S. EPA, and whether there's been feedback?
Okay, this is Rolf, so I can start for the first project. Our project is the development of a, so it has not been used before. It, in fact, we're building the first prototypes right now, so there's no data. But we believe that if we succeed here, that we produce exactly such a device, something that is applicable to human health and exposure assessment.
Great, Jim?
The answer would be sort of. So the answer is, again, this tool is not necessarily an end in and of itself. It's a way to develop the information to make decisions on ecological and human health impacts. Here we're focusing mostly on human health impacts. Early studies on the device have mostly looked at how well does it work, but there is another project we have funded by the Superfund Research Program as part of a program grant, where we are looking at metals in mine waste and how it affects the downstream behavior of metals in floodplain soils, and in conjunction with human exposures to metals associated with mine waste.
Great. Dr. Ghosh?
I would say that there are some data gaps in the use of data from passive samplers and indirect ways of measuring water concentration decision-making, and that's part of the motivation for our research to link up these measurements and be able to inform decision-making model. So I would say there are data gaps that that make it difficult for direct use of these measures. I have been involved in several projects where data that come from indirect measurements of pore water concentration have been used as part of weight of evidence to build a certain understanding for a site. But I think we have some ground to cover in making these measurements useful for direct interpretation of risk at a site.
That makes sense. Dr. Unger?
Yeah, I would say that that's really sort of the goal of our project here is that we've picked the oyster as the organism, the target organism, because oysters are the potential target for human health risk assessment in pH contaminated estuarine environments. So that's actually really one of our goals, is to establish this as a technique to look at bioaccumulation in oysters and ultimately predict the risk for human health exposure.
Dr. Gann?
Yeah, I think definitely. Well, first of all, this is a very good question. It's a question we always ask ourselves. So in this case, I think, there should be a good potential for the further application. For example, you can introduce the E value in the models. And basically, E will serve as a correction factor, so it should be very easy to use. And again, since I've been doing this for the last 8, 10 years, I know, people working on this topic, that's an ultimate question they always want to answer, the real application. And the simple correlation is not good enough, so quantitative prediction is going to be the next step. We all realize that's a very important step.
That's very well said. That's exactly what we're going for these grants. And who knows, maybe in 3 years' time when these grants are concluding, we'll have a much better idea of how we can utilize these tools for ecological risk assessments or even human health risk assessments. But certainly these are great opportunities to advance the tools and technologies that are out there. I'd like to offer to the phone line participants, if you have any questions for all of the presenters, or if there was just one question you really wanted to clear up with one of the presenters in particular, please ask that question. We have time for a couple more, and all you need to do is press *7 to unmute your line, state your name and your organization, and ask your question. And again, any of the online submitted questions that we didn't get to, we will certainly make sure the investigators have those questions and we'll get back to you. So *7 to unmute your line.
This is Rick Beach with AMEC again. Thank you for the opening again. I was afraid to ask another question. I had was I was looking at the different techniques and whether or not they were being applicable, and I think I can see them for each one of them. When they're using analytical techniques to evaluate the freely dissolved component of a contaminant of concern, but there were some where it wasn't clear whether or not they were how they were dealing with the colloids in the sample. Particularly, I think it was the fluorescent technique, whether or not they were removing colloids prior to their analysis with their antibody fluorescent technique. Or just were they doing just filtration?
So, Dr. Unger, that sounds like.
Yeah, I think that
works.
Yeah, initially we're going to just use filtration.
Okay. Any thoughts on using alum to clean things up before analyzing it?
We could try that. For our initial experiments, we were just planning on looking at the filtered fraction, but we could try that to see how that affected both the antibody response to the colloidal fraction as well. It's a good idea, actually. That's something we should probably look into.
You were working in surface waters, if I remember correctly.
We're going to be looking at both surface waters and pore waters.
Okay, yeah, it'll be a bigger concern in the pore waters.
Right.
Okay, well, good luck on it.
Thank you.
That's a great question. Are any other questions? *7 to unmute your line. Is there any more questions for our researchers? So we had a question come in from Bruce Duncan. He's with the EPA, Office of Environmental Assessment in Seattle, Washington. He asked, how could you use your device to determine whether a bivalve tissue concentration represents exposure from pore water/sediment or overlying water? This question might have been directed to Dr. Gann specifically.
Well, I think in my case, I think, we can probably take samples from either the sediment and then take sample from the overlaying water. I want to add that, in our case, the isotope exchange method can also be used for water samples, like pore water or the overlaying water that has small particles and colloidal material. And I think it really depends on where you take the samples.
Great. And then another question, just so people understand your technique, Dr. Gann, you can apply this in situ?
That's a good question. We have, given the time, I didn't go to the other part of my project, of our project. For the other side of the project, we intend to label the SPME fibers with stable isotope label compounds as performance reference compounds. That has been done for polyethylene films and things. So that's that one is good for in situ. But in this case, you have to take the samples back to the lab and, do the extraction, shaking and stuff. So it's not for in situ application.
Okay. Great. That gives us a better idea how it would be used in the field or not used in the case. Listen, we're about at 5 o'clock, and that's about the end of our airtime for today. I certainly want to thank all of the presenters today for their excellent presentations. Among the listeners, thank you so much for really great questions. We certainly hope that today's webinar has given you a flavor for what these research projects will entail, and certainly has given our investigators some food for thought based on your questions. And we look forward to the opportunity to getting back to you. Those of you whose questions we were not able to answer, we will certainly get back to you as soon as we can. And again, I'd like to thank our presenters, Dr. Rolf Halden, Dr. James Ranville, who gave the presentation, and Dr. Jim Schein, who helped answer the questions for the presentation from the Colorado School of Mines, Dr. Paul Ghosh, Dr. Michael Unger, and Dr. Jay Gann. Really thank you for taking the time to prepare and share your presentations today. I'd like to thank Justin Crane for all of his assistance in getting this webinar together. He's operating behind the scenes as we speak, and really couldn't do the webinar without him. So, again, I'd like to ask for those of you who are still on the line, please have a look at the feedback form. This is the first time we've done a kickoff webinar, so we'd love to hear what you think and whether we should do this again or if you have any suggestions. Real important for us to hear from you all. And again, I just want to thank everybody for your participation, your great questions, and for tuning in. So at this point, I'm going to conclude the webinar and hope that you will tune in to the next Superfund Research Program webinars. Thanks very much.